this country is at war with Germany.
We shall go on to the end.
I remember the sheets of flame which came up and almost blinded us from our guns.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. Rodolfo Graziani, Marshal of Italy, Viceroy of Ethiopia and one of Mussolini's most valued generals, remains to this day a divisive figure in his homeland. Revered by some Italians as a patriot and vilified by others as a murderer. From the Allied perspective, he was the Italian general whose troops surrendered en masse to the British during Operation Compass, which almost knocked the Italians out of North Africa in 1941. But what is the true story of Rodolfo Graziani? Today I'm joined by James Citrullo. James has translated for the first time from Italian the biography Rodolfo Graziani, Story of an Italian General, written by Alessandro Cova. Now, this podcast is brought to you with the kind contributions of fellow listeners. If you think there is a vast machine at work in the background with assistants, researchers, audio engineers all beavering away, paid for by a philanthropic millionaire, you would be wrong. It is just me. But I could use your help. All this costs me, and it's not just my time and software. Research material is also an ongoing cost. How can I help? I hear you cry. Well, if each one of you tossed a shekel in my virtual tip jar at patreon.com/wwtpodcast, I had a pretty good monthly salary, but I appreciate that not everyone has the luxury of spare change. But if you do enjoy the show every couple of weeks, why not go to patreon.com/wwdopodcast and become a patron? Think of it as like subscribing to a magazine, but rather than a piece of plastic tat you occasionally get taped to the front cover, I'll give you some audio extras from the chats I have, bits left on the virtual cutting room floor. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast for membership details. James, thanks for joining me. As I said in the intro, Graziani, in terms of the Second World War, is perhaps best known for coming very close to losing North Africa to Richard O'Connor and General Wavell in 1941. But Graziani was a seasoned soldier. So before we get to North Africa, let's look at his past. What is his background? Was he born into a military family?
Well, no. So Rodolfo Graziani was born in Choccheria, which is the folkloristic name for the sort of mountainous region to the east of Rome. It was a very isolated and provincial region. He was born in the village of Filatina, which is the highest village in this region. His father was a local doctor who was quite poor. And meanwhile, his mother was a sort of more well-to-do woman from Rome. Oddly enough, one of Graziani's ancestors, the only illustrious ancestor Graziani had, was Muzio Clementi, who was a famous composer from the 1700s. Muzio Clementi was a rival of Mozart in Vienna. And I say oddly enough because Muzio Clementi died in England. He became an Englishman and his descendants live in England. In fact, there was even a RAF general in the Second World War called RAF General Clementi. So yeah, that's the odd thing. He was related to a sort of minor general of the Second World War. But yes, no, Graziani came from a very sort of poor background. He wanted to go to the military academy, but his family was too poor to afford the expenses. So he went to Rome to study at university. He was called up. This is how he joined the military. He was simply called up when he was 18 years of age. He became a reserve officer cadet. He wasn't in the army. It was sort of like the officer training corps in England. So you're in the military, but you're not actually sort of an officer. But 2 years afterwards, there was a commissioning course for these officer cadets to be turned into regular officers. And there are about 300 participants, and Graziani came third. I think only 30 passed his course. So in 1906, at 24 years of age, is when Graziani becomes a regular officer without actually having gone to the military academy. And 24 years of age is actually really old at that time to start your military career. For example, General Wavell, who would defeat Graziani in the Second World War, in 1900, when he was 18 years of age, was already fighting in the Boer War. So you see this, and when they met on the battlefield, Graziani was Marshal of Italy, and Wavell was just a general.
What's the Italian army like, this period before the First World War?
Yeah, so basically, the turn of the century, the Italian army was an army known for being a poor fighting force. There had been a series of disastrous defeats. For example, in the 1860s, there'd been the Battle of Custoza against the Austrians, which had been a humiliating defeat. But more recently, in the 1890s, when the Italians tried to colonize Ethiopia, they had been beaten by the Ethiopian emperor at the Battle of Adwa. And this was the first time a European army had been defeated by an African army, so it was a huge humiliating defeat. However, many young Italians were still inspired by the story of the Italian unification by the military leader, Giuseppe Garibaldi, who unified Italy. So this is the legacy that led many young Italians to become officers in the army. And this is the context into which Graziani joined the army. Because he was too poor to live in Rome and live the social life of the officers, many, just much like in England, being an army officer was sort of an extension of your social life. So Graziani was sent to the colony, the Italian colony of Eritrea. He was, unfortunately for him, he caught malaria and had to be sent back to Italy. So he didn't fight in the 1911 Italo-Turkish War, in which the Italians conquered Libya, took it from the Ottoman Empire. However, in 1915, First World War starts, and this is Graziani's first major test of Graziani's military career. Because Graziani was from a poor background, from Choccheria, he spoke in very plain language, he spoke in language seasoned with swear words, and he spoke in dialect. And he hadn't been to the military academy, so, he wasn't this haughty officer from the military academy. And because of this, he was very much well-liked by his soldiers. Here was an officer who risked his life, with his fellow soldiers, who lived with his soldiers, and this made him really popular with the troops. Many Italians back in those days were quite short because of most people quite poor. But Graziani was, he was almost, I'm going to say almost 2 meters tall, but in English it would be...
It's 6 foot, isn't it?
Yeah, he was about 190 centimeters, so 6 foot. Because I grew up in Italy, I don't use the English system. So I apologize for all the English people who feel offended by that.
I was scrabbling to work out how tall 2 meters is.
But anyway, he was really tall, so he was this really menacing figure for not only for his soldiers but for the enemy. And at the end of the war in 1918, Graziani, because of the valor he demonstrated in the conflict, he became a colonel. So in 1906. He was a lieutenant at 24 years of age. He could expect to finish his career as a major. And yet, 12 years after he joined the army, he was already a colonel. So he made this huge leap in the ranks.
A colonel is very much a hands-on officer posting. Is there an Italian staff college? Did he get sent to a staff college to get to the sort of that next tier of command?
Because the First World War was a very urgent need for people to go in the ranks and everything. Graziani was probably promoted because he had fought all the battles and everything. So this is a criticism that was made of Graziani. He'd never been to any sort of staff college. He only went through the ranks. It was a criticism and also a praise. They rose through the ranks only thanks to his capabilities.
We'll visit him again in 1914 in Libya, but that's not the first time he's sent to North Africa. He's posted in the 20s, isn't he?
Yes, so in the 1920s, which is where Graziani becomes a sort of important historical figure. Graziani is sent to Libya to pacify that colony, which during the First World War, because Italy was focused on the fighting in the Alps, Libyan rebels had taken control of most of the colony. The Italians were relegated to the cities on the coast, such as Tripoli, Benghazi. There was no real precedent for insurgency, anti-rebellion operations in the Italian army. But the Italians had really no idea how to deal with this situation. But Graziani, as soon as he gets into Libya, he does things that many of the Italian officers don't do. He brings the fight to the Libyan rebels. You know, as I said, for many Italian officers, it was important to, you know, they didn't really, you know, as I said, the army was an extension of their social lives. But for Graziani, that was completely different. It was being a soldier, knowing how to fight was the most important thing. You know, whilst the Italian officers were very keen to play it safe, Graziani took the fight directly to the Libyan rebels. The Italians in general would move in Libya usually early in the morning or late in the evening when it was very cool. But Graziani decided to march directly into the rebel-held areas during the day when the sort of scorching African sun advised against long marches. So when Graziani arrived to sort of a base of the Libyan rebels and they were busy making tea, he descended on them and massacred them completely. And the Libyan rebels couldn't, there was a myth that sort of the European soldiers could not survive under the African sun, and Graziani sort of broke this sort of myth. And in this way, Graziani conquered all of the Libyan colony, arriving deep inside the Libyan desert. It was in Libya that two important relationships were established for Graziani that would be important for his career. The first one was with Marshal Pietro Badoglio, who was basically the embodiment of Italy's military establishment. Badoglio had been an important general in the First World War, and he was sent to Libya as the governor of Tripolitania. And at this point, they got on very well, even though Graziani was someone who, because he was a self-made man, because he thought he could do it his way, he was always someone who was suspicious of people above him who he thought weren't doing their job right. But in this point, Badoglio and Graziani got on quite well. However, there was another relationship that Graziani established in this period, which would define his entire life, and that is the relationship with the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Now, they met for the first time in the late 20s, when Graziani was very famous because of his exploits in Libya, and they immediately got on quite well. Both from similar backgrounds, so Graziani from the poor background of Ciociaria, Mussolini from the rural setting of Romagna. His father was a blacksmith, and yet he had now become the leader of Italy, and Graziani from Ciociaria had now become an important military general. Mussolini appreciated Graziani. He was a general who wasn't, as I said, a haughty officer from the military academy, but someone who had gained his ranks on the battlefield. And Mussolini thought this was the new embodiment of sort of a fascist general who didn't fear combat. And also because many of the, you know, the fascists suspected the Italian generals of being more loyal to the king rather than fascism. So Mussolini immediately saw this man and said, see, this is a collaborator, I can do it. And Graziani also, you know, he had been rejected by the military establishment because he'd never been to the military academy, because he was very intolerant of others who he thought weren't doing a good job. And here was the Italian dictator himself appreciating his work. This basically came to the point where Graziani often ignored the chain of command and dealt directly with Mussolini whenever he needed.
Is he a party member? Do we know?
No, actually, because he was so busy, he actually gained an honorary party badge for a battle. He took part in Libya with one of the fascist militias, but it was sort of he didn't ask for it. Graziani only started making pro-fascist statements only in the early 1930s, because at the beginning he'd only been a colonel, so he wasn't a really relevant figure. When he starts becoming a relevant figure, he starts making pro-fascist statements. You might think, oh, Graziani was sort of a fascist, but actually he was mainly a defender of the established order. When Italy was a monarchy, he was in favor of the monarchy. Mussolini was the first person who accepted Graziani. So Graziani embraced fascism. When Mussolini collapsed, Graziani tried to ingratiate himself with the monarchy. Then when he saw the monarchy wasn't doing the good of the nation, he returned to the fascists. At the end of his life, when he was the honorary president of the Italian far right, this Italian far right party, the Italian social movement, he made statements in favor of the Italian government, which greatly irritated the far right party members. Graziani is someone who was a patriot and a defender of the established order. When the established order was fascist, he was a fascist.
He has dynamic political leanings.
Yes, basically. Yes.
In Libya, they become with Badoglio, they sort of become. They shift, don't they? As they get on top of the military situation, they become more civil administrators, you know, making changes, and the work must have got easier for them. Well, what struck me was, what's he like as a leader, you know, for his men? Because it's very easy to look when you start to win at officers and with trappings, you know, they start to enjoy the trappings of power rather than hard work. And at this period, I mean, you can think of people like Goering, you know, who enjoy the trappings of power and don't really enjoy the work. I just wondered where, you know, how does he fall into that sort of work ethic as a leader?
When Bedalia hated Graziani, said Graziani is only good for being a battalion commander. And that's really a very apt description. Graziani was very good with, you know, being with the troops. As I said, he spoke in sort of simple language. He spoke in dialect. He was a very rough person. He wasn't like Bedalia, who was a very sort of aristocratic, sort of sophisticated person. And actually, that's very true. You know, when Graziani had to be a staff officer when he was made the chief of staff of the army, he proved to be, he wasn't really adequate for that role because he was someone so good in dealing with the troops. So yes, very good. In the field of battle, you know, in Libya, he risked his life. You know, he was the one who led the expedition to defeat Libyan rebels. I mean, he went deep into the desert with his soldiers. And have you seen it in the First World War as well? Graziani was 15 months on the front line with his soldiers. So yes, he was in that case very good. When he had to command an army in North Africa against the British, he proved that he wasn't up to the task.
From Libya, he's sent to Somalia. And is that 35?
Yeah, so I just finished the story in Libya. So in early 1931, Omar al-Mukhtar, the rebel leader, is hanged. The situation in Libya stabilizes. Graziani had used very brutal methods, such as concentration camps. These camps were used much like how the British used concentration camps in South Africa. From Libya, sent to Somalia in 1934 to prepare that colony for the up-and-coming invasion of Ethiopia. Now, the second Italian invasion of Ethiopia was actually a very popular war in Italy. Italy was challenging France and Britain, who were sanctioning Italy for trying to invade a sovereign country. Italy was sort of, if Italy won, it would have gone up in the rankings of sort of world powers. So in Italy, this was a very popular war. Any old person in Italy who lived through 1935 remembers all the songs and the slogans from that period. So in 1935, war is declared. Italy declares war on Ethiopia. Who was told by the general staff that you need to stay on the defensive because the main offensive is coming from Bedalia from the north. But Graziani, who was now an intimate friend of Mussolini, he said to Mussolini, listen, I can easily attack from the south and do away with the Ethiopian emperor. And so Graziani went on the attack. The Ethiopians were armed with very primitive weapons, probably the same weapons they defeated the Italians with in the 1890s. However, the Italians used an extraordinary amount of force, you know, the air force, tanks, and also they used poison gas. You know, why did the Italians use so much force against the primitive army? Well, it was thought that Mussolini didn't want a repeat of 1896 when the Ethiopians defeated the Italians, so he used an excessive amount of force. This caused great scandal abroad because nobody knew, you know, has Italy used gas or not? You know, much like today, the use of chemical weapons is very controversial. And in fact, Italy only admitted in 1998 that it had used poison gas. It was that serious. The accusation was that serious. So yeah, Graziani attacks. He takes the village of Negelli, which makes him a sort of hero in Italy, for the capture of the southern city of Harar. He's made Marshal of Italy. So the man who started his career, the simple officer, you know, simple reserve officer cadet, had reached the highest rank in the Italian army. When he reaches Addis Ababa, Bedalia is there to meet him, but Bedalia who'd advanced from the north from Eritrea, but Bedalia leaves immediately, and he leaves this disastrous, rebel-stricken country to Graziani. Graziani was actually, to his credit, was actually a very honest individual. He didn't cultivate social connections. He didn't have the sort of political power base he wanted to defend. All he thought about was being a career soldier, about waging war. The Doge, on the other hand, he was chief of, you know, he was Marshal of Italy. He was chief of the general staff. He had a sort of political base in Italy he had to defend. So him being in Ethiopia for too long wasn't actually quite good. He needed to sort of return to Italy as soon as possible. Graziani's tenure as viceroy. The Ethiopian soldiers who had faced the Italians, because the Italians were so powerful, they basically retreated into the countryside. And when the Italians established the Italian Empire in Ethiopia, they now started a guerrilla war against the Italians. This was a very chaotic situation, and Graziani was very brutal. It was very brutal, and he ordered some mass executions against rebels and suspected rebels. However, the result was only the intensification of the guerrilla war. The climax came in 1937 when an assassination attempt was made on Graziani. Graziani was in Addis Ababa overseeing a ceremony of handing out of arms to the poor. Two members of the Ethiopian resistance who were in the crowd started throwing grenades at Graziani and his entourage. Graziani was severely wounded. The right side of his body was peppered with shrapnel. Immediately, the Italians of Addis Ababa and the fascist militia started sort of going on this mad hunt and killing, sort of lynching in the Ethiopian population of Addis Ababa, because they thought this was, that a sort of rebellion would have occurred, the locals would have risen up. Some massacres were occurring in the city. Graziani didn't order this sort of immediate reprisal against the civilians of Addis Ababa, but he did order the subsequent rounding up and execution of all the Ethiopian intelligentsia. So anyone who had a degree with any sort of education, who'd been an officer in the army, who'd been in the previous Ethiopian government, he had executed, because he blamed them for the assassination attempt. The worst massacre occurred at the convent of Deborah Libanos. The monks of this convent had been accused of having given refuge to the assassins, and they were mostly executed. This was the worst atrocity committed by the Italians in Ethiopia. It was the worst atrocity committed by Graziani throughout his entire life. It is the main reason why Graziani is such a controversial figure in Italy today. Why, despite having been an important military officer, he cannot really be rehabilitated in modern Italy, because he effectively order this sort of bloody reprisal against Ethiopia's intelligentsia.
Did they order the gas attacks as well? I mean, who can they put a pin on for the gas attacks? Is Bagdoglio tied with the same brush when it comes to gas attacks, use of gas?
Well, no, Graziani asked Bagdoglio and the Minister of the Colonies. Bagdoglio was already using gas in Eritrea from the north. Graziani asked, or he also asked Bagdoglio, who was his superior at the time, and Mussolini, instead of getting a reply from Bagdoglio or the Minister of the Colonies, Mussolini himself, he said to Graziani, you can use gas for supreme reasons of defense, but the Italians also use gas for an offensive way as well.
So it's not as if he can hide behind somebody else and point a finger at somebody else for the use of gas.
No, absolutely. Graziani, he even admitted it. Later on, when he was on trial, as I said, Graziani was such—he wasn't a scheming person, he wasn't a sneaky person, but the opposite. He was almost too honest, and he said, "Yes, I used poison gas in Ethiopia."
So, how is he? He returns to Italy, doesn't he? How is he greeted in Italy? You sort of alluded to the fact that people were following the popular campaign in Ethiopia, Abyssinia. Does he return a hugely well-known figure?
And absolutely, he was already a well-known figure during the Ethiopian War. And when he returned, he received a hero's welcome in Rome and all the major cities of Italy. Many cities decided to offer him honorary citizenship. He received thousands of letters, sort of fan mail, and he was incredibly popular. After the Ethiopian War, Graziani and Badoglio were the two most important generals in the Italian army. Because Graziani hadn't been to the military academy, because he'd come from humble origins, he was the more popular one. He was the person who the young people admired more. So we can almost say that Graziani was the most important military leader of Italy coming up to the Second World War.
You've got that moment where they enter the Second World War. Mussolini brings them into the war. Do we know how Graziani feels about the outbreak of the Second World War? Does he look at the Italian army and think, ooh, it might be tough going like the First World War? Or does he look at the Italian army and think, well, look at the Germans, we can do that?
Yes, this is a very interesting question. Let's go a bit back when Graziani returns from Ethiopia. He returns from Ethiopia. Mussolini's a bit disappointed of how Graziani handled the situation in Ethiopia because the rebellion had just gotten worse under him. There's an interesting anecdote in the book. Graziani and Mussolini meet. Graziani didn't understand why Mussolini was ignoring him. So he said to him, maybe I'll tell him that I'm going to leave Italy. So he told Mussolini, oh, I'm going to Somalia to work on the farm I was given there. I'll be going soon. And Mussolini, who he thought was going to say, oh, no, stay here because there's a war going to happen in Europe. But Mussolini said, oh, yes, do go. Make sure that you grow lots of bananas because Italy's economy needs. And Graziani couldn't understand why is he ignoring me. But a year later, 1939, Hitler invades Poland. Mussolini orders a major government reshuffle in the Italian government to prepare Italy for war. And in this government reshuffle, Graziani is made chief of staff of the army. Badoglio criticized this decision because, as he said, you know, Graziani's never been to the military academy. He's never been to a staff college. He's only ever been fighting wars ever since the First World War. And to this, Graziani replied, no, exactly, because I've always been on the battlefield. I'm the most sort of adequate person for this position. But actually, Badoglio was actually right. So even though he was Graziani's rival, he was quite right because Graziani would be very unimaginative as chief of staff of the Italian army. He didn't really bring anything to the table. One thing you will have noticed by reading the book is that Graziani didn't really keep up to date with any of the major developments in the warfare that were coming up into the 1930s. Most importantly, the mechanization of armies and the use of mobile divisions. But really, this wasn't also Graziani's fault. It was actually a problem which the entire Italian army was facing, because this debate on whether there should be a mechanization of the army, whether Italy should improve its tanks, had never actually come up in the Italian army in the 1930s. Indicative is a quote by Marshal Badoglio when seeing the German blitzkrieg in Poland. Badoglio remarked, oh yes, we will study this after the war. We have nothing to learn from the Germans. In fact, the Italians were allied with Germany. Germany would prove one of the most sort of advanced nations. Hitler's blitzkrieg was truly swept away, many countries. And yet the Italians, for nationalistic reasons, they refused to believe that they really needed to be taught a lesson by the Germans. It was only when Italy started losing, all in Greece and in North Africa, that they admitted that they actually needed German help. And the Graziani was no different. Graziani was the same. He thought, Italy can do this. We don't need any help from the Germans.
In some respects, that must be a reflection upon what the army had been asked to do since the end of the First World War. It's essentially a muscular colonial police force.
Exactly. Graziani was a good general dealing, with colonial problems, fighting against the people who weren't technologically advanced, like the Libyan rebels and the Ethiopians. But unfortunately, when it came to fighting against the British, against the Allies, they proved to be wholly inadequate. But as I said, this isn't really Graziani's fault. It's a problem of the entire Italian army. The person responsible for this situation was actually Marshal Badoglio. He had been chief of the general staff for 15 years before the start of the Second World War, and he never saw it fit to expand the technological advancement of the Italian army. I mean, he was about 70 years old when Italy entered the Second World War. He was quite an old fellow.
Yeah, do we know how Graziani, at the outbreak of the Second World War, did he hanker for a combat posting somewhere, or did he obviously goes to North Africa? Did he want to go to North Africa and try to see action before the war was over? Did he think it was a foregone conclusion?
No, yeah. So Mussolini thought when Hitler was invading France and he was winning, the German troops were pouring into France. Mussolini thought, okay, now we have to enter the war. Because Mussolini was a man of the old school. So basically, if there was a war between Germany and France was defeating Germany, that meant that the war was probably as good as over. So in June 1940, Mussolini decides, okay, yes, Italy will enter the Second World War. So Mussolini, in his speech, said, we have sent a declaration of war to the ambassadors of Britain and France. So Italy has a border with France on the northwest, where the Italian Alps and the French Alps border. The French were in a state of collapse. The Italians attacked the French with Rodolfo Graziani going personally to the front line to oversee the operation. But the Italians only advanced a few miles in the French territory. They thought the French were about to collapse. They think we're just going to advance and they will start leaving their positions. But the French fought doggedly against the Italians. They couldn't believe their country, which they thought was sort of their traditional ally, had sort of, it was called a stab in the back. There was no real plan for attacking France. And so I think about 9 days after Italy entered the war, France was already asking for an armistice with the Germans. But in this small period, these 9 days, the Italians made absolutely no gains in the Alps. And even the French Navy bombarded Geneva, killing a few civilians, which were the first Italian civilians to die in the war. This was how Italy entered the Second World War. So there was in this sort of improvised sort of military operation, which would characterize really the Italian army for the rest of the war. However, the French campaign, as it was called, only because it was so short, didn't really leave a great impression abroad. No one really noticed it. And even Graziani and the fascist regime could convince themselves that, well, really, this hadn't been a real test of our military forces. And actually, Graziani, in his diary, says, oh, well, attacking, the French who command the Alps would actually have been difficult for any army. So really, this wasn't, let's just say that next time, when we have the next battle, we will obviously behave in a more dignified manner.
So he's sent to North Africa. Is he sent to North Africa to take the war to the British, or is he sent to North Africa to hold North Africa in case the British attack?
Well, this is what happens immediately after the French campaign. Graziani goes home to Choccia just to relax, and immediately the day after this, Italo Balbo, the commander-in-chief in Libya, who was a famous fascist official, was shot down by Italian anti-aircraft guns over the skies of Tobruk whilst he had been leading a reconnaissance mission. And Graziani, who had been in Libya for almost more than 10 years, who hanged Omar al-Mukhtar, who else but him could have been chosen to take up this position? Graziani protested, because when he had been chief of staff of the army, he had seen the poor preparation of the Italian army, and he didn't think that the Italians could really do it. However, obviously, this was Mussolini's decision to send his favorite general to Libya was, obviously that was his decision, and he couldn't really argue with Mussolini. So Graziani was sent to Libya in June 1940. As you said, why was Graziani sent to Libya? Basically, he was sent to Libya for political reasons. Mussolini believed Hitler was going to, France had capitulated, Britain was going to be invaded. And now Mussolini thought, we need to attack the British in Egypt so that we have a victory put on the negotiating table. Because the French campaign hadn't really brought any major victories that Italy could sort of show for itself. It was time to have this major victory in Egypt and conquer the Suez Canal. So this is why Mussolini sent Graziani to Libya, because he was, as I said, he was the embodiment of the fascist general. When Graziani gets to Libya, the situation was somewhat chaotic. There had been various border skirmishes between the Italian and the British troops in the Libyan desert. Immediately, it had become obvious that the British tanks were far superior to the Italian ones. The armor of the Italian tanks were too thin to resist the British cannons and the British machine guns. However, by the time Graziani had arrived, the situation was sort of a bit stabilized. The Italians were repelling these British sort of incursions into Libyan territory. The opponent of Graziani in the North African theater was the British general Archibald Wavell. Wavell and Graziani were two actually very introverted individuals, but Graziani was Italian, so he was very shouty, very short-tempered and impulsive. Meanwhile, Wavell was a very sort of Victorian gentleman, was very quiet. In fact, that's what people said about him. He was so quiet, he almost didn't say anything. Churchill really disliked Wavell because he was a general who always gave him these sort of monosyllabic answers. He couldn't really show his worth. And Churchill obviously was someone who liked speaking a lot. So he really, really, really suspicious of this sort of very quiet British general. But Wavell didn't become a general for no reason. He didn't just become a general in the British army for no reason. So he was more of a thinker than Graziani. Whilst Graziani was popular with the troops, Wavell was more of a sort of theoretician and a strategist. Before the Second World War, Wavell had actually campaigned for the mechanisation of the British army.
Does he attack because he's told to attack by Mussolini, or does he attack because it's the right thing for the Italians? They feel it's the right thing for the Italians to do, the British, because they vastly outnumber the British as well, don't they? It's an enormous force at his disposal.
Absolutely, but whilst Wavell was very sure of his strength. You know, Wavell, yes, he saw the Italians were about 150,000, and he was quite concerned about this. But Wavell, if you read any biography of Wavell, you see Wavell is quite sure that the British fighting force is ready for an eventual Italian attack. Graziani, on the other hand, as you see in the book, was very unsure that his troops could actually carry out the task that was put ahead of them. He saw how inferior the Italian tanks were. Now, there were two main Italian tanks. There was the L3 tankette, which had a two-man crew protected by 12-millimeter sort of armor. But these tanks were sort of reminiscent of the sort of tank prototypes of the First World War. These tanks were completely useless. And as soon as the battle started, Graziani saw how inadequate they were and they would never be used again. The only tank that was a sort of threat to the British was the Italian M13 tank, which was a sort of medium weight tank that was actually had a cannon and its armor was quite thick. However, these had only come in production in July 1940, so Graziani didn't have many of these at his disposal. But coming back to your question, yes, Graziani basically not knowing what to do, knowing probably it was better to do something than not to do anything. September 1940, the 13th of September 1940, Graziani invaded Egypt. Basically just to please Mussolini. Mussolini had sent him a letter saying, oh, Britain's going to be invaded any moment now, and, you know, all you have to do is attack. Graziani attacked, and he reached the town of Sidi Barani, a sort of irrelevant village that was a few miles near the Libyan border. In Italy, there was huge elation. Oh, finally, Italy is about to conquer Egypt. You know, we're going to show the British and fascism finally is proving its worth. You know, Mussolini thought that if Italy conquers Egypt, you know, Italy will become an even greater power on the world stage. And not to mention that finally Italy has a great military victory to display to the world. However, this elation was short-lived because Graziani stopped the Sidi Barani and he didn't go any further. Such was his insecurity about going on with the invasion. He was so insecure that he started building a new road up to Sidi Barani, and he started building an aqueduct to get water to the troops, when most armies would have just had a sort of mobile sort of the lorry service which would have distributed troops. Distributed water.
It's a fantastic feat of military engineering that seems to lack any form of will to want to press aggressive there's no aggressiveness there, but it's sort of well thought through from the logistics point of view.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, why did Graziani, who had been so, who had always taken the initiative in Libya and Ethiopia, why did he do this? Some people said that after the assassination of Temple Addis Ababa, he'd become a really sort of nervous and scared individual. Others said they justified Graziani saying, listen, the British were obviously much more superior to the Italians. The Italian tanks not really challenged the British tanks. And others, on the other hand, have said that Graziani was too prudish, and that if he had simply fought like Wavell did, he would have simply obliterated the British because he had 150,000 men. Graziani himself had opposed invading Egypt, so obviously if he had opposed the invasion, why would he go through it? This is how Italy was so catastrophically defeated later on, just this improvisation, this unwillingness to go forward, this sort of insecurity is how Graziani was eventually defeated. And Graziani entrenched himself in Egypt. And Wavell had a force of 35,000 men, vastly inferior, but a lot more advanced, a lot more mechanized than Graziani. His forces could easily maneuver in the Libyan Egyptian desert, whilst Graziani's force was so huge that it was a very sort of gigantic, sort of clumsy force. When Wavell sees that inexplicably Graziani has stopped in the desert, he immediately thinks, okay, something must be very wrong with the Italians. Why aren't they exploiting this success? Immediately, Wavell orders the initiation of Operation Compass. The reason this came about was the Italian formation, the Italian front line, wasn't a continuous front line in the desert. The Italian army constituted a series of sort of fortified islands in the desert with huge gaps in between, which could have been, which way before, these could be easily exploited by our tanks. And that's basically what happened. Wavell encircled all the Italian divisions in Egypt. The Italians, who didn't really know, all they did was they defended themselves, fought to the end, but basically stayed put in their position whilst the British controlled all the deserts, and they just encircled and finished off these sort of pockets of resistance. And immediately Graziani ordered the retreat from Sidi Barrani, that the Italians fall back into Italian Libya. However, the Italians retreated in the sort of traditional sort of road that led into Libya, whilst the British effectively freely controlled the entire desert and easily harassed the Italians retreating orderly into Libya. But even the British, they besieged the main Italian towns like Bardia and Tobruk. And the Italians, who couldn't really oppose the British with the tanks of their own, simply stayed put and fought until the last man. This was obviously, very brave for the Italians, but actually was completely pointless, because the war in the desert was meant to be a sort of dynamic war where you sort of raced in the desert, maybe you retreated, so then your enemy had a sort of longer supply line, shortening yours and everything. And the Italians were sort of a very rigid fighting force. When they were attacked, they sort of, entrenched themselves and fought to the end. This was completely pointless. And Graziani, unfortunately for him, didn't understand it.
He asks to be replaced as the army's collapsing. I mean, thankfully, I guess for the Italians, the British halts, don't they, on the border. And he has to be replaced. Now, I wondered, it's an odd thing, because I wonder if he's defeatist. What excuse does he give to want to be replaced? Has he decided they've lost almost before they started? You don't see Rommel, when he's thrown back, asking to be relieved of command. I find it such an odd thing for a senior commander to say, oh, okay, can you replace me, please? But the army hasn't quite completely and utterly collapsed, but he's wanting out. Is he looking to pass the book?
Yes, that's basically what happened. After the British take Tobruk, it's obvious, Tobruk was an important port, and the capture of Tobruk made front page news across the world. There was the Battle of Bay de Fom. The Italians, who were retreating towards Tripoli, found themselves once again encircled by the British, and they were completely annihilated. Obviously the British had taken Cyrenaica, the Tobruk, the main cities in Syria, you know, the western part of Libya. And Gratiani, as I said, he didn't really know how to oppose the British. He fought, you know, the Italian tanks. You know, Italy didn't have, you know, armored columns and mechanized divisions. Italy didn't have a panzer division it could really throw against the British. And this is the reasoning Gratiani gives when he sends letters to Ciano, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and to Mussolini. He said, oh, yes, you know, the most important thing about the modern warfare is having tank divisions. You know, it's important to have tanks. Mussolini, he believed, without them, we're basically lost. I can't do anything here. So he asked, yes, and this was a very controversial telegram he sent to Mussolini, you know, I want to be replaced, please send me back. You know, to understand this, you know, he's brought about one of the most catastrophic defeats in not only in Italian history, but in sort of world history. So obviously, I think anyone would feel very sort of dejected after something like that. Before Operation Compass, Italy was seen as a sort of military power equal to Germany. The Germans were winning. Okay, you know, the Germans had destroyed Poland and France, so before even Italy was the same thing. After Operation Compass, Italy's rank in the Axis plunges. Italy is the weaker vessel in the alliance. Immediately, the Germans start building military bases in Italy in order to support the Italians. And immediately, Mussolini asks Hitler, you know, please send the Panzer Division to Libya to help me, you know, to help to, you know, stop the British invasion of Italian Libya. Yeah, Gratiani, you know, doesn't know what to do. And he thought he'd done all he could. But also Gratiani, most importantly, as you've seen from the letters, he thought that this defeat had been brought about by his enemies. You know, Pietro Badoglio, who'd never given him the right weapons, by the Italian military establishment who disliked him, and, you know, by the people, the bad advisors around Mussolini. And it's what Gratiani would think until his death. This was never my fault. This was your fault because you didn't give me the right sort of equipment.
Who did everybody else blame? If Gratiani blames everybody else, who does Italy and Mussolini blame for the defeat in Italy? Well, certainly Mussolini won't blame himself. He'll blame, you know, everybody else. But, you know, what do the, does he come back, return to Italy? You know, I'm sure he can't be a hero. Is he a defeated hero? Is he can't be triumphal? How's he?
Yeah, Gratiani is the main enemy now of Mussolini and the fascists. You know, this is why, you know, Gratiani, yes, he was, embraced by fascism, but now that he was defeated, he becomes the main scapegoat of Mussolini and the extremist fascists within the fascist party. And Mussolini hated him, mostly because Mussolini had basically helped him gain prominence. And now this general, who was meant to be the embodiment, as I said, of the fascist general, had so catastrophically been defeated. This was a huge blow to Mussolini and to the fascist regime. Gratiani returns and he lives. He's basically in the wilderness. He has no official position whatsoever. He basically returns to his farm that he built in Choccheria, in his home region. Basically just being a farmer, just living sort of private life, completely ignored by the Italian government. Mussolini was very angry at Gratiani. We can see this from the diary of his son-in-law, the foreign minister, Count Ciano. Ciano, Mussolini on a certain occasion says, you know, after the war, Gratiani won't be a marshal of Italy. We'll try him and we'll have him executed. Really, absolutely infuriated with Gratiani. He established an investigative commission to investigate how the defeat in North Africa came about, and Gratiani was basically, the verdict was basically, yes, Gratiani was responsible for this defeat and he should be punished. However, because the war was going a bit badly for Italy, Mussolini, they sort of didn't really carry out the sentence. They were more important, they were bigger fish to fry, basically. And Gratiani was allowed to simply live his sort of the life of a pensioner. You know, he had his wife. He was very loyal to his wife. He was a very loving family man. You know, he had his dogs. He loved his dogs. More, as it says in the book, more as a friend than a master. His diaries are filled with very sort of some mundane entries, like I'm planting the poplar, I'm picking the potatoes. He sort of is sort of attacks against his enemies. Oh, I saw this general who insulted me. I heard he insulted me, so I didn't say hi to him when I saw him. I just ignored him. This was how Graziani was living.
It's very odd that the state didn't find some way to utilise him. You know, often German generals sort of get put on the bench and then come back a little while later when it's sort of everything's forgotten and they're desperate. But he is just sort of ostracised and left to potter around his farm. And it's really odd that they didn't make him, I don't know, Minister of Recycling or something completely bizarre. You know, they seem to get... Important people seem to get other jobs that are less important and they have to sort of scrabble the way back up the tree again.
Graziani had failed completely initially, so that it would have been almost humiliating to have him return, I guess. So, you know, that was the difference. I mean, Mussolini actually, when he removed someone from a post, they would never come back. For example, the secretary of the Fascist Party, Achille Sciarra, who had been party secretary for 9 years, when Mussolini removed him in 1939, he basically never came back. He died a sort of poor man in 1945. So that Mussolini never actually forgot, the people who to him had done him wrong.
The odd thing is, though, when Italy surrenders in 1943, you've got Bergoglio now swaps sides, doesn't he? And he surrenders Italy. But Mussolini does approach Graziani again.
Well, you see, that's the mystery. Did this actually happen? Did Mussolini actually want Graziani to come back? We'll never know. Graziani in his diary says, "Oh, Mussolini has read my defense statement where I justified the defeat in North Africa and he agreed with me." But as we read from Chano's diary, this couldn't happen. How could this be possible if Mussolini was saying they hated Graziani, that Graziani was a coward? It's very different sides to this argument, but it has never really been confirmed whether Mussolini wanted Graziani to return before fascism's collapse on the 25th of July 1943. Some evidence suggests that the fascist hierarchy really disliked Graziani. Some people even thought he'd become an anti-fascist.
Which makes you wonder why they asked him back, or is there just nobody else of his stature to ask?
Exactly. So when Mussolini is toppled on the 25th of July 1943, Badoglio, Graziani's rival, comes to power. A few months later, on the 8th of September 1943, Badoglio secretly signs the armistice with General Eisenhower, where Italy unconditionally surrenders to the Allies. Graziani, who was there simply tending to his farm, he thought that this unconditional surrender was really shameful. You know, Italy was allied with Germany, now it's sort of switching sides. Hitler invaded Italy and created a fascist puppet state. It seemed that the fascists wanted Graziani to become the Minister of Defense of this new fascist republic. Graziani, as I've said, before the Second World War, he'd been the most important Italian general of the Italian army, so he still held that sort of prestige. Now, Graziani hadn't been the first choice Minister of National Defense. There had been other generals, and then Graziani had been, I guess they chose Graziani because the others had refused. So, obviously, Graziani still had his use because he'd been a Marshal of Italy, because he'd been Viceroy of Ethiopia. That was probably the main reason. Mussolini obviously was in no state to sort of pick and choose, because now he was just a puppet leader and he just had to choose the ministers for his new republic.
It also seems an odd position for him to accept, because he'd been circumspect about the chances in North Africa to start with. Against the British, he's seen the Allies, take Spain, Sicily. Sorry, he's seen the Allies take Sicily and attack Italy. They're in the ascendancy. He must have known what was coming, yet he accepts the role.
This is another mystery. Why did Graziani do this? I believe that Graziani's defeat in North Africa was so cataclysmic that he thought if he were to jump in the fray once again, he would have had his chance to command the armies of Italy and inflict a terrible blow against the Americans and the British who were invading Italy. I think this is one of the main reasons. Obviously, his rival Badoglio It was now the leader of the Kingdom of Italy in the south, so he wanted to have his revenge on Badoglio, I guess. Yeah, no, and Graziani had to be convinced. He had to be convinced by the Germans, even with threats. Obviously, it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just that, you know, he'd also been threatened, so that's probably the reason why.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to you in a moment. I'm joined by James Trullo, and we're talking about Marshal Graziani. How successful of a commander was he at this period, this closing period of the war? So you never hear much about the Italians.
Graziani would never be able, you know, from 1943 to 1945, he was never able to deploy Italian divisions against the Allies in Italy. Graziani joins the Italian Social Republic. He immediately sets about creating an army, an apolitical army, that could defeat the Allies, the American, the Commonwealth and American forces who were advancing up the Italian peninsula. You know, there was the landing of Anzio, Cassino. But basically, the Germans didn't trust the Italians anymore. They didn't think that, you know, the Italians were treacherous. They couldn't be trusted. Graziani managed to negotiate a deal with the Germans where the Italian prisoners of war who had been captured by the Germans when they had invaded Italy after the 8th of September, these Italian prisoners of war who were in the concentration camps, he got a deal that they would be trained as soldiers of the Italian Social Republic and deployed to the south to fight against the Allies. Graziani went to Germany to review these divisions of Mussolini. There were three divisions, you know, infantry divisions, marine divisions, mountain infantry divisions. Many soldiers volunteered to fight in this sort of new army. Graziani went to the Sennelager, which is a military training camp in the north of Germany. Sennelager is right next to Teutoburg Forest, where the Romans were massacred by the Germanic tribes, and he made a speech like, oh yes, we will. You know, even the Romans were defeated, but we will, you know, we'll have our comeback, I'm sure. But however, when these divisions returned to Italy, when these Italian men returned to Italy, the Germans simply sent them to fight the partisans in the mountains. And that was a very violent, hate-filled war where Italians killing other Italians. You know, the history of the Italian campaign of the Allied invasion of Italy, it was basically a war between the Allies and the Germans. There were never really any major Italian units were sent to fight the Allies. You know, Monte Cassino, the Battle of Ortona, the liberation of Rome, all these famous battles. It was always the Germans fighting against the Allies. There had been a few Italian sort of special units that the Germans trusted, like some Italian paratroopers and some Italian Marines, but these were units that were independently controlled by their commander. Mussolini had no authority over them. So these were the only Italians who fought against the Allies. The only fascist Italians were these sort of independent, you know, very well-trained soldiers whom the Germans trusted because they were good soldiers. And that was basically it. Graziani would never have his day where he would never had this his major battle where he avenged the defeat in North Africa.
So how did his war come to an end? Because obviously Mussolini's owned by the partisans.
So Graziani, the situation deteriorates. There's a mass insurrection by the partisans. Graziani escapes Milan with Mussolini, goes to Lake Como. This was a very, you know, there's full of stories what really happened to Mussolini, how was he executed. These all happened in these sort of few days on Lake Como. Graziani goes into a villa in Cernobbio, which is a village on Lake Como, guarded by the Waffen-SS. The Germans have surrendered, so they have to basically give Graziani to the partisans. As soon as Graziani leaves this villa, however, he is met by a OSS agent, Emilio Q. de Dario, who saves Graziani. Later on, hands him over to the Americans in Brescia. And the partisans wanted to execute Graziani, but he managed to get out alive thanks to the help of the Americans. And so, yeah, this is how Graziani's military story ended. He was basically rescued by the Americans.
How is he treated? Is he seen as a prisoner of war? Is he a criminal, a soldier, or a political prisoner, you know, after the war? What hat does he wear?
For the Allies, so he's sent to Algeria, and he's a prisoner of war there. Then he's sent back to Italy, and he's just a prisoner awaiting trial. The Allies had never instigated a sort of Italian Nuremberg, because they wanted to keep Italy on side, you know. But, you know, Badoglio had switched sides, so obviously they couldn't inflict on him a sort of Italian Nuremberg. Even Badoglio would have been put on trial if there had been an Italian Nuremberg. So Graziani is just like many Italian, you know, many high officials of the fascist regime. He's just he's put on trial through a normal court. In these trials, Graziani, when he's in prison awaiting trial, Graziani writes sort of massive defenses, massive books, which were basically like a sort of defense of his actions, where he justified what he did in Libya and Ethiopia in the Second World War. He sent thousands of insulting letters to journalists who talked badly about him and all that. Any perceived slight, he would react with sort of very vicious attacks. But anyway, he's put on trial. He was defended by probably the best lawyers of the day, all of whom had been anti-fascist during the fascist regime.
Were they appointed to him, or did they volunteer to work for him? Because that's an interesting point, if they're anti-fascist.
One of these lawyers, Carnaluti, for example, is someone who would have a long history of defending sort of fascist politicians in the post-war period. And as I said, they were all anti-fascist, but however, they had been anti-communist, anti-fascist. So they saw the defense of Graziani as sort of fighting against the sort of communist sort of media that was defamating many of the people, many of the fascists of the Second World War. The civil lawyers thought that they were not able to judge Graziani because there were so many military questions coming up. Graziani was sent to a military tribunal. The military generals were very favorable with Graziani. They were generals themselves, and Graziani was a general. He was a colleague, so they weren't very harsh with him. They sentenced him, even though Graziani's accusation was that he was a traitor, but they said, you know, Garibaldi was considered a traitor when he tried to conquer Rome against the wishes of the Italian government. Gabriele D'Annunzio, the famous Italian poet, had fought against the Italian government for patriotic reasons. And they said Graziani basically fits in this category. He's been accused of treachery, but he did it for reasons that because he loved Italy, because he loved the nation. Graziani was sentenced to 19 years imprisonment. After the war, the Italian government had seen how many people had fought under fascism. So they thought it's not a good idea to exclude these people from Italian society. So there were a whole series of amnesties were enacted by the Italian government. Graziani basically fit into this amnesty because he fought under Mussolini. And so he was released from prison a few months after he had been sentenced. After the war, Graziani's life in the 1950s isn't particularly important, but he became the honorary president of a neo-fascist party, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian Social Movement. And as I said, he joined this party because he felt he was of far-right sympathies. But as I said, because he'd been a general, he always saw the merits of the Italian government. And once, when Giulio Andreotti was a Christian Democrat government official, came to Trocceria, he just said, you know, I think the Christian Democrats were in power, have done a very good job, and, you know, you're doing much for the land of Trocceria, which was very poor, now it's very rich, which his party comrades thought was, you know, why are you praising the enemy? You know, this is our electoral, these are our adversaries. But that was Graziani. He was a mishmash of contradictions. He was a very goofy character. He used very colorful language. He spoke in dialect. He'd been defeated, you know, he was the underdog. That's why some Italians still admired him. You know, a lot of the soldiers he'd fought under Graziani admired him. When he died, there was a huge funeral the traffic in Rome was blocked. And in those days, that was quite rare. But that was based, that is the story of Rodolfo Graziani, a very controversial, liked by some, hated by others. That is the life of Rodolfo Graziani.
What I found amazing was that, you know, there's a, you know, just when you say about his funeral, I think I made a note, 100,000 people attend his funeral. And it's fascinating that, you know, it's really hard to put a pin in quite who he was or how, you know, how people felt about him, because he'd obviously lost in North Africa, but he's a huge pre-war general. He sides with Mussolini. It's so complex. Yet all these people come out to honour him on his death when he could have just quietly have been buried and forgotten.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was someone, he loved the adulation of the crowds and everything. So, and yeah, he'd been a very important figure, you know, before the Second World War, during the Second World War. So that's why, you know, I guess, and all the soldiers fought under him, like, and that's why his funeral was so big. But no, he really, Graziani always wants to be at the center of things. And he'd always had been. So even after the war, that's why he became honorary. He accepted to be honorary president of this party. He always really wanted to be. He didn't want to be forgotten. And he was, to the end of his days, he always engendered controversy. And even today, Graziani continues to be a controversial figure in Italy. After his death, he was mostly forgotten. But in 2012, the mayor of his hometown, the village of Ascoli, he built a monument in honor of Graziani. And ever since then, it's been a whole never-ending source of controversy. Whenever there is an anniversary about Italian colonialism, about a battle that occurred in Africa, about some atrocity, Graziani's name always comes up, no matter what. The most funny sort of recent scandal was a company that makes pasta. They'd put out this new sort of a short pasta called Abyssinian pasta, because it's a sort of pasta which the Italians had invented whilst they were in Abyssinia. And this was a variness of how could you do this? You know, how could you forget about Rodolfo Graziani and the massacres he did in Ethiopia? So they had to stop selling that pasta because of that.
Is the controversy now his Second World War record or his colonial pre-Second World War record?
It is his colonial pre-World War II record. That is why Graziani is remembered. Obviously now in Europe, people are looking at what Europe did in Africa. And Graziani was basically, he was the general who committed the worst atrocity, the massacre of Addis Ababa, and that is why he is remembered today.
It's funny, he's not remembered for siding with Mussolini or his defeat in North Africa, but for his colonial record. Well, James, we'll leave things there. Thank you for joining me. Loyal listener, if you want to know more on the topic, the book to read is Rodolfo Graziani, Story of an Italian General. Don't forget, if you have enjoyed this episode of the podcast, you can support the show by becoming a patron. The details are at patreon.com/ww2podcast. So that is it for this episode. Next time, we should be returning to the Pacific. After talking to Henry Sledge about his father and the Pacific TV series, I thought we would take a look at another central character of the show and Medal of Honour recipient, John Bassalone. So until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
Jerry, 88mm gun hit our tongue, blew us the hell out of it.
Stalingrad can never be repaired.
As Allied Commander-in-Chief, I have granted a military armistice.